All right. Hi, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for our In Conversation with Dr. Chandran call. If all of you just joining us could mute your phones, that would be appreciated. And I am now going to turn it over to Dean Tomaselli.
Thank you, Pam. And thanks, everybody, for joining us in this In Conversation series regarding COVID-19. In just a minute or two, I will introduce Dr. Kartik Chandran, who's one of our senior faculty members and an expert in emerging viral illness, but I'll talk about that in just a minute. Let me give you a little bit of an update about where we stand from the Einstein perspective. If for those of you who listened to the radio this morning, Dr. Ozawa was on Morning Joe, and I think he did a great job at summarizing the trajectory of this pandemic as it relates to Montefiore and Einstein. On March 11th, we had 3 patients in the hospital who had COVID-19. By the first week in April, we had over 2,000 patients with COVID-19. That's the bad news. The good news is the number of patients is starting to stabilize. However, it's that number that at which these we have patients in the hospital is still around 1,900 patients right now. So this is a remarkable stress on the health system with, again, starting really from zero to having about 2,000 patients with this viral infection in our hospital system. We believe that with mitigation, this number has been actually kept down, and it could have been a lot worse. The other bit of hopeful news on the health system side is we're now starting to see that the number of patients discharged who've had COVID-19 is starting to exceed the number of new admissions. So that's, again, hopeful news. On the medical school side, we've today, in fact, are graduating a little over half of our medical school class. They will join the healthcare workforce and will be participating in the care of these patients. As you can well imagine, with this number of patients, we've had to expand our capacity to many other venues, health venues, which ordinarily don't take care of adult patients, including our children's hospital and some of our outpatient ambulatory settings. And our students have already been volunteering and doing absolutely fantastic work, some in direct patient care, others that are manning phones to do telehealth with the existing patients who are not COVID patients in our health system and our occupational health service. They've also been involved in working on doing testing for the virus, manning some of the machines that actually do the tests themselves, and using 3D printers to create PPE, including masks as well as face shields. So I want to thank everybody on the phone for their interest, their support of what we're doing, and for your incredible alignment participation in the efforts that we are we're actually pursuing here in response to this pandemic. So let me from here introduce Dr. Kartik Chandran. Kartik is a professor of molecular biology and immunology, and he's the Harold and Muriel Block faculty scholar in virology. Kartik is an expert in Ebola and has actually been a leader in this field and emerging viral pandemics for the last several years. He leads a rather large grant and contract trying to better understand these diseases. And what I'd ask him to do today is to talk a little bit broadly about his research and talk a bit about how the work that he's done previously and the work that he's doing now is relevant to the current COVID-19 pandemic. So, Kartik, thank you very much for joining our call today.
Can you all hear me okay?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, great. So yes, my name is Kartik Chandran, and my group has been interested in emerging viral pathogens for more than a decade since I've been at Einstein. There are many viruses out there that have animal hosts that can jump into people and cause severe disease in a way that's quite unpredictable. Ebola is a great example of this. Influenza is a great example of this, and now COVID-19 SARS, the original SARS, and then this new virus called SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID-19. My research group is interested in understanding what is it about these viruses that allows them to jump from their normal hosts, where they typically don't cause such severe disease, to humans, where sometimes in a manner that we can't always predict, they can cause severe disease and these sorts of larger epidemics and even pandemics. So our research is really looking at the fine details of the how the virus interacts with our bodies to find a sort of a hospitable environment to copy itself and make more viruses, and how that can actually cause disease as a result. So that's one aspect of what we work on, and we focus on other groups of so-called emerging viruses like Ebola, like hantaviruses, some more sort of exotic viruses that maybe aren't household names yet. And as this COVID-19 pandemic has expanded, we have pivoted to start working on COVID-19 to actually try and understand what is it about this virus that allows it to infect people and cause disease. That's one aspect of what we do. The second aspect of what we do is actually learning from our own immune system to develop drugs to treat the virus. And so for Ebola, we've actually gone into were able to find a person that had recovered from Ebola virus on their own, and they had mounted a very strong immune response against the virus. And in particular, we were able to go in and fish out these antibodies, which are these Y-shaped molecules that can bind to the virus and block it, and kind of pin its arms down and keep it from doing what the virus needs to do in order to infect cells in our body. And the thing is that when you get infected with a virus like Ebola, like COVID-19, you make thousands and thousands of antibodies. And what we go in is we find these very specific two or three antibodies. We actually fish them out of the ocean of your immune response. And these two or three antibodies are exquisitely well equipped to fight the virus, to block it. And so what we can do is we can take these antibodies and actually manufacture them as a drug in large amounts so that it can be given to many, many thousands of people. So we've been successful in doing that for Ebola. So we started with 300 antibodies from somebody that had survived Ebola, had mounted a successful immune response. And from those 350 antibodies, we were able to find two that when we use them in combination, they're incredibly effective at protecting animals from Ebola virus infection. We could even give the antibodies once the animals had already become quite sick and had developed disease, and we could reverse all of those symptoms and rescue all of the animals from Ebola just with this combination of two antibodies. So one of the things that we are doing with COVID-19 is trying to apply that same strategy. Dean Thomas really alluded to this large contract we have. We have a consortium of which I am the head, that involves many different institutions in academia, in government, in medical schools, in companies. And we are all working together as a team to find people that have recovered from COVID-19, look at the library of antibodies that they make and really use them to find the best, very best antibodies that we can then produce in large amounts to use as a treatment. And so this is, we're sort of at the beginning of this, but we're very excited about this as a strategy that could be helpful to fight this virus. Even if it doesn't prevent infection, it could hopefully reduce the severity of disease in individuals that have developed a severe infection. This sort of work takes longer to yield its fruits because there are a number of steps involved, and then we have to actually manufacture a large amount of this drug, and that all takes time. So in the short term, we're actually working with Dr. Lizan Porofsky, who was on in conversation with the last time, to actually just take the liquid part of the blood, the plasma, from people that have recovered from infections and give that as a drug directly. So the downside of this is it's a rather precious and rare commodity. The positive side of it is that we can be ready to do this right now. And given the number of people that have recovered from COVID-19 and are willing to help out, we potentially have a lot of people from whom we can get plasma. And our role in this, so Dr. Lizan Porofsky is leading this effort here at Einstein Montefiore, and our role in this is really to look at the plasma from all of these different donors and find the best plasma, in terms of the amount of antibodies against the virus that are present in this plasma, to give to people that are sick. So that's one aspect of what we're doing that we think is actually very urgent and, you know, something that can help immediately. And then the second aspect of it, which is sort of related, but also has to do with, you know, it's a bit different, but also has to do with antibodies, is, you know, there's a lot of interest and a need for people to know if they've been exposed to the virus and are making antibodies against the virus. So we are working with the pathology department here at Einstein and with the clinical diagnostics labs at Montefiore to develop an antibody test that can be our own test. So instead of buying this from a company, we can essentially take a test that my lab has developed for finding antibodies against COVID-19 and adapt that test to be able to run it in the clinical lab so that we can actually screen our healthcare workers and others to see if they've actually been exposed to the virus and are making antibodies. So as you can see, there's a theme that runs through our work, which is, you know, antibodies, and we're doing three different things. One is trying to find the best plasma to use as a treatment, trying to develop an antibody test that can be run at the hospital, and in the longer term, trying to develop these antibodies, selected antibodies as drugs that could be given to people with COVID-19.
Great, Kartik, that was fantastic. I think there's a couple of questions that have been asked previously, and maybe I'll start with those and then we can open it up for more questions. I think you've described quite nicely the immune response and the immune response in terms of fighting the virus. Can you talk a little bit about the immune response and how that impacts on ultimately the development of a vaccine for COVID-19?
Yes. So I think we can learn a lot about how to develop a good vaccine if we study the natural immune response that happens, you know, in response to infection. And so that is also actually a fourth thing that we're working on in collaboration with Dr. Prowsky, Dr. Joanna Daly, others at Einstein, to actually follow people longitudinally over time, people that had mild illness, people had more severe illness, and then actually track their immune response and see how it changes, not just at the level of the antibodies in their blood, but also the cells that are producing the antibodies. So one kind of question that, you know, we were trying to answer that everybody wants an answer to is, what can I, depending on how much antibodies against COVID-19 I have in my blood, what can I say about my risk for being reinfected and getting sick again? And this is a question that we don't have a clear answer to yet. And so we're hoping to learn more about, exactly how the antibody response in individuals translates to their being protected or being immune from the virus. And with some other coronaviruses that we know about from before, we know that this response can wane over time. People can actually, lose some of these antibodies. So we want to be able to track that with this particular virus over time and understand how that changes. And by looking at the kind of antibodies that are made to what parts of the virus, we can actually use that knowledge to optimize and refine the vaccines that are being currently developed, and maybe even develop new vaccines that can do a better job of eliciting a very strong immune response. So in the short term, we want a vaccine that can work to protect people. But in the long term, we want it to be a durable response, which means that we can give people one shot of the vaccine and they're good for a significant period of time, like a year. And we don't actually know right now if the vaccines that are currently being developed will allow us to provide that to people that get vaccinated. For all we know, once they get a vaccine, it might only last for a few months. So we need to make sure we develop and tweak the vaccine to provide the best and the longest lived response that's possible, while balancing the fact that we need something as fast as possible. So that, you know, we're trying to balance the equation in terms of how quickly we can get to something and then how effective it's going to be to the people to whom it's administered.
Great, thank you. That anticipated one of the questions about immunity and how durable immunity might be if somebody is infected. And a related question was, how likely is it that COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 will mutate in a way so that it behaves almost like influenza? That is, you need to get vaccinated every year because the virus is constantly changing, and in doing so, it's escaping surveillance by our immune systems.
So I think based on what we know about other coronaviruses, and it's dangerous to extrapolate because SARS-CoV-2 is a little bit, is quite a bit different than a lot of the endemic human coronaviruses. But we don't really see the same pattern with coronaviruses that we do see with influenza in terms of this rapid high level of mutation and mutational escape from the vaccine, from the antibody response. And I think one reason for that is because coronaviruses, this whole family of viruses, are somewhat unusual compared to other viruses that have RNA as their genome. So just as a little backgrounder, viruses are the only organisms, if you want to call them that, that can use RNA as their genetic coding mechanism. So they store their genetic information as RNA. In all other kinds of, whether we're talking about bacteria or fungi or animals or plants, we use only DNA, and the RNA is only there as an intermediary messenger of information. But many viruses actually use RNA itself as their primary way of storing their genetic information. And what we see is that RNA viruses, as opposed to DNA viruses, mutate much more rapidly. And so, for example, influenza, there's this issue about the virus escaping or antibody surveillance or the vaccine. However, there's a trade-off between the mutating of the virus and the its ability to preserve the integrity of its genetic information. This limits the size of the viral RNA to quite a small size. So if we look at DNA viruses like smallpox, for example, they have huge genomes because DNA can be copied much more accurately with much fewer many fewer mistakes. So they can tolerate much larger genetic information storage. But RNA viruses like influenza have much smaller pieces of RNA because they mutate so quickly that it would get garbled very quickly if they had a very big piece of RNA. Coronaviruses are unusual in that they're sort of in between. So they actually have bigger RNA genomes than influenza, Ebola, a number of other RNA viruses. And as a trade-off for having this bigger RNA, they also have a lower mutation rate. So compared to other RNA viruses, coronaviruses actually have a lower mutation rate, and based on what we know from the endemic human coronaviruses, this seems to be less of an issue for these viruses in terms of mutating. Probably the bigger issue with coronaviruses in general, especially the ones that normally circulate in humans, is that they seem to generate relatively weak immune responses. And these immune responses seem not to persist and to wane over time. So it's not so much that the virus is escaping the antibodies, as that there's just not a strong or really robust response generated in many individuals, which means that when the individual is exposed to the same virus again, they can still be susceptible to some degree, although probably not susceptible to severe illness. So this is similar to what we see with some other respiratory pathogens like respiratory syncytial virus, where people don't develop lifelong immunity, unlike say with measles or something. But usually the subsequent infections are not as severe. And so I think that's the other sort of nuance here, which is that although it may very well turn out that once you've had this virus, that in a few years you may be susceptible again. The real issue with this virus is not that it infects people, but that it causes this very severe airway disease and kills people and sends people to the hospital and puts them in the ICU, where they require oxygen and eventually ventilators. So if you had it once, you did okay, and then even if you're susceptible again, maybe like a year from now, if you just develop an upper respiratory infection, then that's not such a huge public health issue as if you were to develop another severe lower respiratory infection. And I think that is really the question that is uppermost in everyone's minds is, if I had this, I developed an infection, I recovered, I mounted an immune response, but it kind of waned over time. If I get infected again, will I again develop severe disease, or will I only have a mild infection the next time? And I think these are the sort of questions that we don't have the answers to yet that we need to try and get the answers to. That was a bit of a long answer. Sorry about that.
No. I think long but informative. So perhaps I could ask you to put on your policy hat here. What do you think we need to do to improve kind of monitoring so that we can move from this state that we're in right now in terms of being sheltered at home to actually having this sheltering at home lifted and being able to get about more of our normal kind of life and business. What do you think we need, and how close do you think we as a country are to having proper monitoring in place to allow this to happen?
Yeah, so I would say that the thing that we really need more than anything else is being able to rapidly test people to see if they've had the infection. And of course, the primary way we've been doing this is by doing these nasal swabs and then looking for the viral RNA in these nasal swabs. That is not 100% sort of test, in that there's a significant number of people who get missed, but nevertheless, you know, it's decent. And from the very beginning, we've been plagued by not having enough of these tests, not being able to test everybody, you know, that needs to get tested. So we need to find a way to dramatically increase the volume, accessibility, availability of these tests. And then we need to combine that with contact tracing. So for those, you know, for people like us who worked on Ebola and some of these other viruses before, we've seen how even countries in relatively poorly resourced settings can actually very effectively combat these outbreaks as long as they can stay limited in size by essentially finding people that are infected, like having a diagnostic test to show that they are exposed, and then immediately quarantining them, quarantining the people they live with, and then doing contact tracing, which basically just means doing legwork, detective work, where you talk to that person, they fill out a questionnaire, you interview them, and then you go and find everyone else that they've been in contact with, and you talk to them, and you give them the test. And if, you know, any of them are exposed, you quarantine them. So the idea is to sort of to choke off the spread of the virus, because I think, you know, even once the number of cases drop and, you know, as Dean Tomasoli was saying, like the pressure on our hospital decreases, only a small percentage of the population has actually been exposed to this virus. So there's a huge reservoir of susceptible people out there that are at risk. And so this virus isn't going to go to zero overnight, and it may never go to zero. There may always be this low background of infection. And so what we're going to see are these little flare-ups of clusters that start from individuals. And our challenge from a public health standpoint is going to be to find those clusters as soon as possible, and then contact trace those clusters and essentially build fire breaks around them to keep the infections from spreading. And this is the difference with, so if you look at countries that have been really successful, South Korea, what they've done is contact trace to test extensively and contact trace very effectively. And there are, you know, definitely, so one thing that, for example, South Korea has done, Singapore has done, is to use the ubiquity of like phones and electronic devices to really as an adjunct for contact tracing, you know, and to actually build and keep databases to track who people have been in contact. Now, I know that makes everybody uncomfortable because there are definitely huge privacy concerns here. But I mean, given that these networks are there, that, you know, tech companies are already using them, you know, to look at what apps people have, and, you know, there's all this geographic, like GPS information that's on phones. I think we need to find a way to maybe use that information to support these types of efforts rather than just using shoe leather to do it. You know, but we need to do it in a way that safeguards individuals' privacy. I don't know exactly, you know, how that can be implemented. I mean, that's not really my expertise, but, you know, from a public health policy standpoint, my feeling is that the most important thing is testing and contact tracing to control the size of these clusters, because once they grow beyond, you know, the second circle to the third circle, they become too large and too difficult to contain unless you geographically quarantine a large area or you go back to doing partial shutdowns or, you know, shelter at home. And I think we may need to do that from time to time where, you know, in a more localized, limited context, we may need to have people go back to the current sort of state of affairs of shelter in place. And I don't think we're going to be able to have large events, public events, for quite some time to come until we can bring this under control. And in addition to doing the kind of RNA testing for the virus, I think as the antibody tests become available, those can also be used as an adjunct, because we're already seeing with our tests that we can, it's not 100%, but it's about 80%. We can detect antibodies in about 80% of the people that have been documented to have a positive RNA swab test within, like, you know, 14 days of them first developing symptoms. And the antibody tests are sort of, you know, if we can combine the RNA testing that we're already doing with antibody tests to look at, you know, because the antibody test will tell you if you've been exposed, not at 100% accuracy or sensitivity, but it will tell you 80% of the time whether somebody has been exposed to the virus or not. So then you can sort of start to build up a database and an understanding of who actually has been exposed to the virus and how to bring it under control. You can do this in a totally randomized way by looking at tens of thousands of people, and certainly there are NIH and others are proposing to do that. But you can also do this in a much more targeted way in the context of this contact tracing process to identify and stop clusters from getting bigger.
Great. Kartik, perhaps one last thing, tapping into your expertise as in Ebola. What is the one or two lessons from your work in Ebola that's most applicable to the pandemic we're experiencing right now?
So, I mean, I guess the first observation is this kind of obvious, but I'll say it anyway. These outbreaks are much easier to control when they're really small. and the Ebola lesson is, for a long time, it was just this exotic boutique virus that killed a few people here and there. It wasn't seen as a major public health threat. But what changed all of that was in 2014, we had this enormous pandemic, a large epidemic in West Africa in three countries. And it started, it was the initial response was less than ideal in that people thought that the virus outbreak had ended, but it was still smoldering at a very low level. And it just flared up again all of a sudden. And then it spread from a relatively rural area to the coast. And there is this coastal highway, a new coastal highway that was built that connected three countries, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea together. And once the virus hit that highway, it was able to spread very, very quickly. And then establish itself in these urban areas where people are in close proximity. And that's where the epidemic really exploded. And it took almost 2 years to bring it under control. And, you know, more people died in that epidemic. And it caused untold amounts of suffering and economic damage compared to any of the previous ones. And so I think one of the lessons from Ebola is that, these outbreaks, you have to bring them under control early. You can't assume you're done because the infection can still be smoldering at some low level and it can kind of flare up at any time. And it's also the synergy of this natural sort of process, this viral infection, with man-made factors and conditions such as urbanization, travel, easy access to transportation, population density. I mean, it's really the combination of these things that makes the epidemic what it is. And so, you know, a virus in a particular situation may not be a huge threat, but when you put it in a different situation, a man-made situation, it can become a huge, you know, problem because of these other factors. And we've seen this with COVID-19, and you know, we delayed, we underplayed the, you know, I think people don't feel exponential growth in their bones, and so people kept downplaying the importance of what was happening by comparing it to lightning strikes and influenza and that sort of thing, and that was not helpful because for virologists, you know, who think in exponentials, we knew this was going to be a huge issue because of, you know, this virus that can spread really easily. And, you know, being able to spread in a naive, immunologically naive population. So certainly one lesson from Ebola is respond early and really, you know, you got to smack, you got to make sure you extinguish that cigarette butt in the dry forest before it catches the bushes, you know, and the fire catches the bushes. And I think we didn't really do that. We sort of, you know, waited too long to act in a forceful way. So that was sort of, certainly one thing we've learned from Ebola. I mean, the second thing I would say that we've learned from Ebola is that antibodies can be incredibly helpful for treatment. So for decades, people thought Ebola was, just too lethal, too rapidly moving to an infection to actually be able to control with antibodies. But what we and others have learned from our Ebola experience is that antibodies act can be remarkably effective even when you give them very late in a primate model where the animals are going to die and they're maybe days away from death. We could actually give these antibodies and reverse them completely. So, I mean, that's not to say it's going to work in every situation, and you know, we'll have to see how it goes with COVID-19. But you know, we have these beautifully honed, you know, sort of tools to fight against infection. And in my belief is that it's these tools that really provide, you know, one of our best opportunities to intervene, you know, against, you know, against this virus as well. But, you know, I guess the data will tell us, you know, how that's going to go. So for Ebola, there's this therapeutic called ZMapp. This was being developed when the West African outbreak started and was very quickly rolled out, or as quickly as possible was rolled out, and was given to Dr. Brantley, who is an American physician who was on death's door from Ebola. And, you know, within 24 hours of getting this infusion of antibodies from against Ebola, this person was able to, you know, was back on the road to recovery. And since then, of course, we made a lot more progress with Ebola antibodies. But, and we're actually working with the company MAP Biopharmaceutical that develops ZMapp on COVID-19 antibodies as well. So you know, we'll have to see what, you know, the universe has a way of, you know, surprising us. But I would say the second lesson for me from Ebola is the value of antibodies as therapeutics. And we're hoping that that'll turn out to be the case here as well.
Terrific. Well, Dr. Chandran, thank you so much for spending some time with us this morning. And I want to thank everybody on the phone for their interest, for their involvement with us, for their support of not only our clinical programs, but our research programs around COVID-19. I would remind everybody, vigorous hand washing. We are still sheltered at home. If you can't physically distance from somebody, make sure you wear a mask. And everybody, please stay safe, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you for coming.